All right. I'm going to give a mercifully short talk about Akbar, just a little primer. This is an experiment that's coming together just now, and it's a collaboration primarily between John Rule here at UCSB and myself, and of course the students and postdocs who are working with us on this, Sean Kuo and Mike Dobb at Berkeley, and John Goldstein and Eric Torbay, who's a postdoc here at UCSB, and then Marcus Runyon here at Caltech, who's a grad student at Caltech, is doing an absolute ton of work on this project as well, and then Jamie Bach at JPL is responsible for the detectors we're using. Peter Aid at Queen Mary College built our filters, and Jeff Peterson is working on a telescope at the South Pole. All right. Of course, you've seen this plot many times. just to say that Akbar is observing in four frequency bands in here, in this sort of angular scale. We have a four arc minute beam, so we don't have quite the resolution of the Susie experiment, but we do have we can cover fairly large. We have a 3 degrees chop on the sky, so we have fairly large scales on the structure. Large scales on the sky, and have and get to fairly low L, and actually have fairly decent resolution in L space as well. The instrument observes from the South Pole. And on the Viper telescope, which is shown here inside its ground screen, the 2-meter telescope, we actually surround it with a half-meter ground shield. So it actually we use it like a three-meter telescope. That shown here is just some tipper data, 350 micron tipper data from Mauna Kea, Chile, and the South Pole. And I'm sorry for the quality of this picture. But this is to show you something. This is actually a measure of the variance in the sky from tipper measurement to tipper measurement, just to give you an idea about how good the South Pole is compared to these other sites. And we're going to make full use of that with this instrument. Tell you a little bit about the bands we're observing in. Very similar to SUSY. We're going for a little bit wider bands, actually, but fairly similar to SUSY. There's a band here at 150 gigahertz. That's looking at the decrement in the SE effect, shown here in black, is the SE effect. So we have, and then shown here in the dotted lines, either red or blue, are the is the kinetic effect. And so anyway, so we have a 150 gigahertz channel, 219 gigahertz channel, 274 gigahertz channel, and 345 gigahertz channel. And shown here are the is the atmospheric transmission from the pole with the Akbar filter bands. And so we've matched these filter bands to have high signal noise to the selected signals we're looking at, and also have low contribution from the atmosphere. And you can see that our 219 gigahertz channel, which is essential for measuring these peculiar velocities, actually is mercifully falls on an atmospheric transmission window. And the 345 gigahertz channel out here we use primarily as a dust and atmosphere monitor. Here's a CAD drawing of the Akbar focal plane. There's only 16 detectors in here. I feel somewhat shamed by the 151 detectors of the last talk, but I'll try to go on. There are 16 detectors in our focal plane here. Four of four colors, and so there are four 345 gigahertz here, 150, 219, 274, and we observe simultaneously at those frequencies. And what we do is we have a chopping mirror in the system, which sweeps the beams back and forth 3 degrees along this axis and azimuth. And in doing so, each one of these beams, we've designed it so that these feed horns, so that our beams are matched and all have exactly the same 4 arc minute beam on the sky, and we sweep back and forth, and we very rapidly pass these four beams over the same point on the sky. So the idea is that we'll actually have some near instantaneous spectral information on the points we're looking at, and that chop is at about 1 hertz. And the reason for that speed is that's about as fast as we can go and still have a requisite number of time constants per point on the sky that we're looking at. And if we go too much slower than that, we start to get atmospheric noise problems. So there's a little bit about the system, probably more than you want to know. NEPs of detectors, noise equivalent temperatures. One thing you should notice is these noise equivalent temperatures are fairly they're not certainly not as low as the kind of temperature sensitivities that are being quoted by Maxima. But then again they're not an order of magnitude lower. And we do certainly have an order of magnitude more or observing time. The idea is we're by being on the ground, we're taking more loading. Our detector is a little bit less sensitive, and we're trading that off against the very large amount of observing time that we'll have. So this tells a couple of things we want to do in that mapping fields to very low RMS, looking for clusters in blank fields. And I'll talk a little bit about more of these in detail. We go through great pains, more so than the Bloom experiment. We want to have very precise frequency bands because we really want to match those atmospheric windows. So we have to worry a lot about our beam patterns. Jason said I was going to show a picture of a bolometer, so I wasn't really going to show this, but. There's one of the spider web detectors that we're using. There's a small thermistor in the middle here, just like a spider web. You know, the cosmic ray wind goes right through the spider web, and the microwave flies get caught in it. And that's that. I want to say here's a picture of our cryostat, and we actually just got cold last night. For the first time, and we got to 240 millikelvin, and held for better than 24 hours, and so you know I actually made this up at last night as well, but anyway the great thing was that was one of the last things that we really had to that we hadn't had sorted out yet was getting our cryogenics working, and that all seems to be working well now, so. Yeah, we've got electronics. Well, one thing I should say is we're using a fairly simple system where the readout electronics are DC biased, but you can see that down here we're at 5 nanovolts per root hertz, down well below a hertz. So the point is we don't have any, we can chop as low as half a hertz if we want, and not our bolometers have something like 14 or 15 nanovolts per root hertz noise. So we really don't have any problem with chopping slower if we have to. From the electronics, it just appears the atmosphere is going to be a little bit of a problem if we chop slower. We've been to the telescope with a mock-up of the Dewar. This is a fake Dewar, which we installed one of our 150 gigahertz feed horns in with a ambient temperature diode detector, and then we put a transmitter about a kilometer away on a building. And this is so it's not quite in the far field of the telescope, but we were able to map. A source that we put out there, and found that we got about 4.5 arc minute, full width half max, and these are for two slices in elevation and azimuth. These side lobes are due to the fact that we're looking through this aperture, and we get some reflection off this bottom plate here as well. But basically, our beam patterns is quite good, and quite well understood, and we're pretty happy about that. So we're pretty confident that we understand the optics of the telescope very well. As well as our feeds, and we're pretty sure we'll get our 4 arc minute beams at all frequencies. So, what are some of the things we want to do? We want. Yeah, it sure does.
So the illumination pattern on the primary is not chopped.
No, the illumination pattern on the primary. There's an image of the primary on the chopping flat. That's right back. You can't see it, but this is the secondary mirror. There's a chopping flat back behind. There's an image of the primary on the chopping flat, and the chopping flat moves, so it wobbles just a little bit on the mirror, but not much. Primary anisotropy. Of course, these are up here are the results that you're very well familiar with by now, And here are some simple predictions as to what we'd be able to do in one strategy when we would be searching with a very low RMS looking for distant SE clusters. This is one thing we want to do. And we'd be going to a lower RMS in our maps. If you do that, we don't get quite as much sky coverage. We have a lot of sample variance. And this is the kind of power spectrum you get. If we go to another option where we're looking at more sky to a lower RMS, something optimized for CMB observations, these are the kind of errors on the power spectrum we should get in 20 days of observation. And I'd say 20 days of observation is fairly short when we're talking about, you know, we're going to have 6 months with a sundown, and we can for a lot of these things we'll actually be able to do for the lot of the cluster observations we should be able to do with a sun up. Without much problem, but for some of the more sensitive things where we're going down to very low RMS like this, we probably want to do with the sun down. But as I said, we have more than enough time during winter. And one thing I should say about the pole, for those of you who aren't familiar, the atmosphere is quite good there. The precipitable water vapor in the winter is down often below 200 microns, and I've done some simulations using actual measured atmospheric turbulence from the Python experiment and extrapolated that to our beam size using a Kolmogorov spectrum and extrapolating frequency. And if you do that and then do sample observations with the actual blowing the atmosphere through the beam, and it looks like in the summer we have some contribution from atmosphere, increases our effective noise by a few tens of percent actually. In the winter we absolutely don't see it. We should be very clean. So, now peculiar velocities. I just want to say, because Jason talked about this. This is something we will do, but it is not something we will have a very difficult time measuring a single peculiar velocity. And the reason is just because our beam is large. And this is some work that Max Tegmark and Martin Heinhelt did for the Planck mission. And shown here is the confusion to CMB for different beam sizes, and this is your confusion in peculiar velocity due to intrinsic CMB anisotropies depending on your beam size, and the idea is obviously as you go to smaller and smaller beam, you can do a better job filtering out the CMB anisotropies. And here at 4 arc minutes, this is for a very optimistic optical depth cluster. You can see we get down to a couple hundred kilometers per second. So it's going to be very difficult for us to measure a peculiar velocity in a cluster unless it's in a binary system or doing something very special. So just want to make that clear. This is a catalog of the XBACS catalog of bright X-ray clusters, and this is now taking realistic estimates of what these optical depths are and looking at this for individual clusters for their size and for their optical depth. And what you see is, yeah, down here at a couple hundred kilometers per second, there's a few clusters. Well, when you look at the RMS expected peculiar velocity of clusters, which is 300 kilometers per second, or something like that, maybe you might be able to detect a couple. But this is not going to be a workhorse of cosmology with this instrument. Just want to make that clear. But the idea is what we can do is you can imagine measuring several of these clusters and averaging together and making some constraints on larger bulk flows. And if everyone believes that the rest frame of the mass in the universe is the same as the rest frame of the CMB, then this isn't interesting. If you think that's something worth thinking about, then this is interesting. And it's a difficult thing to do. People trying to do this with empirical distance indicators have had a long history of conflicting results and problems with these sort of measurements. So it's something we will do. It's not the flagship science goal of our project, but it's certainly something we'll go after. One thing we really want to do is image close clusters. We want to look at a sample of close X-ray selected SE clusters and take a look at them. Here are some 10-hour observations simulated for some bright clusters with a half a millikelvin central decrement, and as a function of redshift. And you can see out here at redshift 1 and even at a half, we're starting to not resolve the cluster very well. But for these closer clusters, we do quite a nice job on them. And so we'll make a nice sample of clusters, at redshift 2 and closer, and try to be reasonably complete about it. We'll be looking at those for making maps of those, looking at the baryon fraction in those clusters, Hubble constant, and also for some of these closer clusters, we'll actually be able to really get in here and resolve the structure for at least a handful of very close clusters, make some nice maps. So, and finally, we're going to look for some distant clusters. This is something Joe talked about earlier today. And one thing we want to do is just pick some blank fields of sky, go down to a low enough RMS to actually find the distant clusters. And as Joe was saying, even though we have a fairly high mass limit, only very bright clusters will we be able to see. We can actually cover these things are very bright. They're fairly rare though, so we have to cover a lot of sky. But if we do that, and we actually do some fairly try to cover some reasonable number of square degrees, we can have a significant yield of clusters. So shown here, this is only about 20 days of observation for Akbar, and it depends on how we do with atmospheric noise and what our actual signal noise is. But this is a reasonable guess, and the idea is that we should be able to find tens of clusters, some number of which will be at redshift 1 and beyond. And so this is really, if nothing else, it has a good chance of being one of the first experiments to actually be able to go out and find a sample of clusters. And the sample won't be huge, but we'll actually be able to do some follow-up. There'll be fairly low redshift. And I think it'll be interesting. And if nothing else, it'll be a demonstration of the method. I mean, one can imagine doing this with a large format array on a modest-sized aperture and just multiply this number up to whatever you like, and that's something left for the future. But the point is that we'll be doing this as sort of a demonstration. And anyway, in this predicted yield, something on order of tens of clusters.
Can you be able to distinguish between the open and the blended model?
I think not. But just because if you look, the statistics we'll have out here, we won't have a lot of clusters, and so actually in determining this number. I think we won't be able to determine those numbers with high precision, and we won't really be able to say much about the shape. But that's right. Yeah, and just here, they're pretty close. So I guess that's as I said, I'm going to be brief, but that's really all I want to say. And this is one of the last. Pieces of virtual hardware, which is just now actually finally built, and so these are electronics boxes and stuff going on there. But the point is, the project's about 90% built now, and the last pieces are sort of trickling in. We're integrating the system in August. We're going to deploy to the pole in November, and that's about it. We're on a fast track with this. This whole thing has come together in the last about a year and a half. And hopefully, if we can make our window to deploy to the pole, which is our plan, we can get this on. We're going to winter over this season, and then hopefully we'll have a second winter over after that, and we should be able to really attack all the science goals I laid out there, in that time. So that's pretty much all I have to say. Questions? Yeah.
You said something about materials between the South Pole and the Chief.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I would have been very negative, or not negative, I would have been skeptical about these sort of statements a little bit more so until a year ago. But with the DAISY program, we had a lot of success deploying a very complex instrument, and it's been running down there now with about 90% duty cycle. It doesn't go down. We don't lose any time due to weather. We don't lose any time due to any problems with infrastructure there, power outages, or anything like that. So I guess I would say is that the infrastructure that exists at the pole is actually pretty good. The problems are the lack of access for 6 months, and that's a big drawback. Well, okay, right, but yeah.
Let me ask you a question. In your bend, is there a significant difference in the particular low vapor?
No. Yeah, well, let me say, it's more than precipitable water vapor. There's precipitable water vapor difference, certainly, and the pole is consistently lower. More so, the advantage that Chile has is there's less dry air. So if you're really going for the absolute lowest loading, you might go to a high mountain site in Chile, and then you're looking through, you have less swings of the oxygen lines, you have less total loading. And so, but the stability is clearly better at the pole. And I can show you lots of documentation to show you that. But I think that there's no question about that. And for us, we don't really care so much if we have 4 Kelvin from the atmosphere or 6 Kelvin from the atmosphere. What we care about is its stability. And for this experiment, we're chopping 3 degrees back and forth. This is going to stress the stability of the atmosphere. You know, these detectors are the most sensitive detectors that have been deployed down at the pole. We're chopping a very large distance. This is going to push the stability of the atmosphere to the limit, and that's why we're doing it down there. Yeah. Well, I think that what we'll do is, just because it's so timely, we're certainly going to go after the power spectrum, the CMB, you know, finite Angular scale power spectrum, is, you know, second and third Doppler piece. We'll be doing that. That's a no brainer. I think that the nearby cluster sample is an obvious thing for us to do as well. It's something we'll be very good at. You know, for cluster searching, we're really curious to find out how well that works, and I think right away we'll learn something interesting about cluster, cluster scaling with Redshift, right? We'll learn something interesting from this year, you know, because, you know, whether those counts are within a factor of 2 right, we'll be able to constrain that. So that's, you know, whether we'll actually do some of the very exciting cosmological goals that Joe was talking about with cluster searching. No, certainly not with his instrument, but it's really just to set the stage for the technique. So, we really do hope to do really those at least those 3 things of CMB imaging, close clusters, and finding some serendipitous clusters. Yeah. Yes, we've talked about it, and it's still an open issue. We could do that in the second season going down. It would not be terribly difficult to do. We could we've talked about using polarization sensitive detectors behind each feed, and going that route. We don't have any cold stop in the system. We have corrugated feeds. We could use polarization sensitive detectors behind them. But it's something that we're still talking about. Yes.
How much work is involved in keeping this thing going?
Let me say that the cryostat is meant to it holds for about 4 days. It may be a little worse when we get all our wiring in. But the idea is that so that's the biggest hassle. It's a winter over down there. It has to go out and fill cryogens once every couple of days. And beyond that, the refrigerator, we designed the whole thing to be fairly automated. And so the refrigerator cycles automatically. This whole thing is controlled by there's a digital bus that goes out there that can run all the cryogenics and do everything that happens with the doer remotely. And you can do that back from the dome. You don't have to go out to the site even. So the real question is if the cryogen fills and any maintenance on the telescope is something were to break. Those are the big issues in terms of winter over. We have our winter over selected. He's showing up in Berkeley in a couple of weeks, and he's going to be working with the system for the next 3 months until we shift. So,
does the Viper telescope have a nice access like maybe to go outside?
Yeah, no. The cryogen fills have to be done out in the cold, and that is that's brutal. It's minus 100 Fahrenheit. But it's been done before. It's happened this year. They've been observing with the Sparrow system, which is another helium-cooled doer on that very same telescope. And that's worked. You know, there've been some other problems with the helium supply down there, but that's worked all year long. So it's I tell you, the future is we will build we will run this you know a refrigerator similar to this. I didn't say that much about the refrigerator, but the helium-4, helium-3, helium-3. Three-stage refrigerator. We'll run something like that off a post, you know, a pulse tube cooler, something like that. The idea is no cryogenic bills, runs continuously. That's obviously what you want to do. This is. Yeah. But anyway, the idea is what we've done here is we've tried to use some existing technology to move into a niche fairly rapidly, and.
That's pretty
good. Is that all? Okay.